Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. My name is David O'Brien. I'm going to be hosting the show for this week. And with me today is
Dominic Rabier
and Ben Snitkoff.
So, getting started, we have a bunch of interesting stories that sort of cropped up this week. Most of it is going to revolve around copyright law. We have a story concerning ASCAP and cell phone ringtones, and another story concerning a New Hampshire RIAA suit. And finally, we're going to tie it off with iTunes gift cards. So our first story is about the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And they are embroiled in a suit right now that involves two cell phone carriers, including AT&T and Verizon. And in the suit, at issue in the suit is that AT&T and Verizon have basically stopped paying royalty fees for ringtones. And what ASCAP does is that they are a licensing group, and they represent over 350,000 songwriters, composers, and music publishers. And they're sort of a central repository for collecting licensing fees. So anytime that people want to use licensing, or they want to license music to use them and publicly broadcast them, they can go through ASCAP and pay sort of either a blanket licensing fee to use a group of songs or individual songs, sort of an easier way to do it and distribute licensing fees and royalties to the actual publishers of music. So, Ben, can you tell me what's going on in this suit and why do we care so much about it?
Yes, so every time a song gets played on the radio, what happens is ASCAP will collect a certain amount of money for the person who wrote the song, but the band who makes the song actually doesn't get any money. The deal was struck in the early days of radio that we were going to, you know, pay the person who wrote the song, but not the band, because the benefit that a band reaps from playing music on the radio is that people will then go and buy the music. But back in the old days, there used to be people who wrote songs and people who played songs. There was, I mean, and it's still true to a large extent in pop music, but a lot of other musics out there, you have people who both write the songs and produce the songs. So essentially what happened is in the early days of cell phones, and by early I mean relatively recent days of cell phones, when you started having music ringtones, people would get licenses from ASCAP for the use of these ringtones, for essentially the performing of the ringtones in public, or even sending the ringtones to people's phones so that they can then, you know, have getting jiggy with it, play when they answer their phone or when somebody calls up their phone.
So how does licensing work? And, you know, what rights, and we've talked about this a lot on prior shows, I mean, what rights do copyright holders have?
So copyright holders have essentially six rights, and there are a couple more that are ancillary to that, but they're in 17 U.S.C. 106. They're the right to reproduce copyrighted works, the right to prepare derivative works, the right to distribute copies, the right to public performance, right to visual performance, and the right to... there's a right to perform copyrighted works via means of a digital audio transmission, too.
So licensing, though, I mean, the rights that authors have, how does that work?
The author could choose to use all of those rights by himself and arrange all of them by himself, but instead what most authors tend to do is they'll join ASCAP and say, you know, ASCAP, here are the songs that I own. I want you guys to keep an eye out for them. And when people use them, either make sure that it's a licensed use, that, you know, somebody has paid, you know, you being ASCAP, or me, the author, to use these works, or charge them a fee, saying, you know, you're supposed to have paid to have used my song. It's my song. I get money whenever people use my song. And essentially that's what this is. This is the licensing scheme is a way of, in this case, a lot of authors of songs, a lot of songwriters getting together and, you know, bundling their music and saying, you can use all of this music if you pay a flat rate to ASCAP that's distributed based on, you know, how much each of those songs is used over a period of time.
Okay, so every time I have my dad call me on my BlackBerry, I have Frank Sinatra's New York, New York come up, and it's sort of screaming through the airwaves. And what is ASCAP saying then about what happens when I do that from a legal perspective?
ASCAP's main contention is that that's a public performance. So if you're out on Boston Common and, you know, 20 people hear that New York, New York starts playing, ASCAP thinks that you just performed this song publicly and that they should get money out of it. There's a small but important problem with that is that there are certain limitations on the right of public performance. And public performances without any intention or chance of having commercial benefit result from them are exempted from being considered public performances. So while ASCAP is claiming that that's a public performance, and this is a 17 USC section 110, it is not a public performance, pretty clearly under the statutory language.
And yet they're still arguing it, though.
They are, and I'm not entirely sure where they're trying to find support for this argument.
Well, I mean, I could give a little bit more background on this story, too. So there was another court decision that came out back in 2007. And by the way, both of these cases have been filed in the Southern District of New York. And in the 2007 case, ASCAP was sort of contending the use of digital song file transmissions over the internet. And they were disputing the rate fees, the standard licensing fees. And the court basically said that the transmission of digital audio files over the internet cannot be considered a public performance. And based on that decision, and by the way, in the decision, the court didn't speak to any extent about what ringtones might be considered and the transmission to cell phones. But based on that decision, some of the cell phone companies have basically stopped paying their licensing fees to ASCAP for ringtones because they believe that such transmission could never constitute a public performance. The EFF had a post on this week, and they think it's pretty ridiculous that AT&T is sort of arguing this. I mean, to some extent, doesn't it make me an infringer every time that I play New York, New York on my phone when someone calls me?
Unless the use is licensed, yes. Dominic, you were going to say something?
My understanding was that ASCAP is arguing that while they have that right, they're never actually going to sue anyone for that, at least not yet. But they just are claiming that they have the right in the context of the litigation, but without actually wanting to pursue that right. It's not like they're suing people for playing New York, New York.
Well, yeah, they'd much rather go after AT&T, who has the bigger pockets. They'd rather, get AT&T for contributory infringement or inducement to infringement than going after these individual people.
Right, so I'm the bad guy in this case, but ASCAP doesn't want to come after me because I'm one of their beloved customers. I like to buy songwriters and composers' music, but they don't want to go after me. They want to go after the person that's sort of facilitating the infringement or contributing to the infringement. And in this case, it's going to be the cell phone carriers. Is there anything that's fair about that?
Oh, I don't know. There's very little that's fair about the law in general, being cynical for a second. I do have a question that maybe you guys can help clear up. So even if this isn't a public performance for ASCAP's standard, I mean, is there also, I guess my question is, to what extent does the band have a copyright as well as the author of the song? I know that there are certain schemes that you have for mandatory licensing for covers of songs, but does the band who covers it also have a copyright? Also have a copyright in the song that they cover? Or do they not, because it's a derivative work?
Well, I think I can answer part of that, at least. There's usually some sort of agreement between ASCAP and the rights holders, or in some cases, those are the actual songwriters and composers of music. In other cases, where rights have been assigned to third parties, it involves third parties. But I think that the best way to think about copyright interests are that there's sort of a bundle of rights. The common analogy that's used in law school all the time is sort of a bundle of sticks argument. So when you obtain a copyright, you sort of get this bundle of sticks, and each stick sort of represents an individual right that the holder has, and they're able to sort of dole out those sticks to people as they like. They can sell them off, they can buy them back, they can trade them, they can do almost whatever they like with them. And so through something like a licensing agreement with ASCAP or some sort of contractual agreement where they allow ASCAP to represent them in certain matters, they've sort of delegated certain of those sticks, certain of those rights. And in the case of ASCAP, it usually deals with certain types of public performance. Now, I don't know, like, you'd have to really see the contract itself to see the exact rights that were given. And I think often what happens is the actual bands will withhold or reserve, which is the word that's sometimes used under the law. They'll reserve certain rights to themselves and delegate the enforcement of other rights to ASCAP.
Okay, that sounds fair.
So anyways, I mean, what do we think is going to happen with this? I mean, it sounds like it's sort of ridiculous.
I agree. There's very little that ASCAP has to rely on. The statute is very clear. It says, and I'm going to quote for a second, performance of a musical work other than in a transmission to the public without any purpose of direct or indirect commercial advantage and without payment or fee or other compensation for the performance is essentially not a public performance under the Act. I don't understand how you can argue against any of those facts that there's any chance of direct or indirect commercial advantage to either... I mean, there's certainly no direct chance of commercial advantage to the person who's using that, which is, you know, you on the common, David. There's just... You're not trying to gain any money off of that. You're not playing that with the hope that somebody will come into your store or, I don't know, give you money in any way. It's just a song that you have playing.
What then are some examples of direct or indirect commercial advantages? I mean, you sort of highlighted a few there. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, it would be a bar that plays loud music, or if the bar even has bands come in and the bands play songs that are covered under an ASCAP license. That'd be an indirect commercial advantage. You have music playing, so people come into your bar and they buy drinks. I was actually in a bar this weekend that had a sign up that said there will be no ASCAP or similar license music's played in this bar. I thought that was a pretty neat sign. I wonder how they enforce that. You know, if they, you know, when the bands come in and play in the next room, if they actually like sit there and go like, okay, what songs are you planning on playing? No, you can't play that one. Direct commercial advantage would be though if you're throwing a concert and let's say it's a James Brown tribute concert and James Brown music is covered by ASCAP. That would be direct commercial advantage. People are coming in to see the concert and you're making money directly off of the use of the public performance of his work.
Do you have any other thoughts, Dominic, about where this case might go or, you know, any other things you might want to add?
I think you guys are pretty much on the ball. I guess the only thing that might be worth mentioning is other people might have heard about ASCAP perhaps once a long time ago. They threatened to sue, but they didn't sue the Girl Scouts in the mid-90s for apparently troop members performing their ASCAP licensed songs in just singing it aloud. And they threatened to sue before they withdrew that. So they have there's a precedent for rather, I don't want to say outrageous, but interesting interpretations of the law.
Onerous interpretations of the law for us consumers, perhaps. I think the case is interesting because over the last 8 or 10 years or so, we've seen a big transition to mobile computing, and you know, now we're seeing cell phones that are being tethered devices, and so they're also used on our computers to access the internet and other data portals, and we're also using our PDAs, our BlackBerries, our iPhones, and et cetera, for accessing a variety of different types of work. And so maybe it's not, you know, totally out of the question of why ASCAP wants to sort of maintain control over this area, because we don't really know where it's going to go to some extent. I mean, technology evolves and society evolves, and we find new and interesting uses and innovations for our technology all the time. So I guess we'll just have to keep our eye on it. For now, it looks like that this is something of a silly argument that they have made based on the way that the statutory language has been set up. But sometimes you never know how things turn out. So anyways, moving on to our next case, we are now going to New Hampshire. And back in 2008, a case was filed against a middle-aged woman named Mavis Roy. And she was accused of downloading and potentially infringing over 200 songs through BearShare, which is another one of the file sharing programs. And she got a bunch of notices in the mail. She had no idea what was going on. She has one computer in her house. It's a Dell computer, and it hadn't really been functioning properly for years. She found the notices to be the legal notices she received from the RIAA to be very confusing, and she didn't really understand what was going on. And so when the case was filed in 2008, she didn't show up, and we called it a default judgment. And what happens then is basically you lose because you didn't come into court after you were properly served. And the court then moves on to go to sort of a damages hearing, and they want to determine a dollar amount for the amount of damages. And the woman, Mavis Roy, still confused about what was going on, eventually got some help from the Franklin Pierce Law Center, which to my knowledge is the only law school in New Hampshire. And they stepped in to help and provided some assistance to try to navigate her through the legal waters. And the end result that came out recently was that the RIAA decided we're going to settle for $0. And that was partly based on evidentiary concerns. They had this one Dell computer. It hadn't been functioning. And prior to the case even being filed or any notices being served, Mavis Roy had given the computer to it was a relative of hers to fix it. And apparently, as the story goes, the guy found a bunch of malware on it, tried cleaning it off, and replaced the hard drive. And so the hard drive had gone missing. But basically that there was a lot of questions that the computer hadn't actually been around during the period of time that she was alleged to be infringing files. So I'm going to sort of open this up to everybody. What's kind of going on here, and why is this interesting?
One thing I'd like to point out before we go on, even if you default, it's not an automatic win for the plaintiff in these cases. And this doesn't happen often, but there have been a couple of RIAA cases where the defendant hasn't shown up, and the judge has either dismissed the suit or demand that the RIAA do more work to prove their case. This hasn't happened very recently, but it is possible to not show up and not immediately lose. But that being said, it's a very bad idea not to show up for your case.
Nonetheless, that isn't what happened here. They did show up, and they got the law clinic. And I guess the important thing to note is the RIAA did settle with prejudice, which means that they're not going to be able to bring this suit again. So this woman has peace of mind with regard to the RIAA suing her on this issue ever again. It's over.
Well, I think what happened is they entered default, and then when the damages hearing came around is sort of when she actually had written to the court itself and saying that she didn't understand the legal documents that she had received, and the clerk of the court basically came back and said, well, the litigation has actually already started. And so I think she came in at the point where they were trying to determine damages, if memory serves. So we talked about this a little bit last week when we were discussing the Jamie Thomas case and the methods that the RIAA has used in determining who exactly is a potential infringer. And up until the release of their statement, I think earlier this year, it might have been even late 2008 that they were going to stop suing file infringers, they had been using a company called MediaCentury to try to determine who is a potential infringer. And MediaCentury uses a variety of somewhat unknown techniques of determining who is a potential infringer across a file sharing network. What do you guys know about this? And there's a lot of limited information out there, but what can we sort of speculate to about how they find potential infringers?
So my understanding of what happens is that the MediaCentury will go on to one of these file sharing networks, be it Kazaa or BearShare, and find a computer that has music on it that the RIAA owns a license to, or is that from a member artist of the RIAA. And what they'll do is then go to that person's shared folder, pull out everything that they can find, download a song or two, and from that information they'll figure out what this person's IP is. And the IP address is just it's a unique, relatively unique address that's given to each computer. I'm kind of being inaccurate here. So the IP address, rather, it's what's the best way to phrase that, guys? Like every access point? So a router would have a unique IP address to the rest of the internet. But if you've got a wireless router that has 8 computers on it, all of those computers should look the same to the outside internet, correct?
They can. Usually they would. It depends on the setup of the network in particular.
Right. So they would then, the Media Century will then find the IP address. Can they also figure out what the MAC address is by connecting to the computer?
They should be able to.
Okay. Right. And the MAC address is a hardware address. So that's unique to not only every computer on the internet, but every network device on the internet. So in my laptop, I've got an Ethernet jack, which has its own MAC address, and I've got a wireless card, which has its own MAC address. I think I have a Bluetooth chip, which also has a MAC address. So they get two identifying pieces of information, and then what they have to do from there is either try to trace the MAC address through the manufacturer of the computer, which I've never heard of them doing, or what they do more often is track the IP address through the internet service provider. So what they'll do is they'll write down the time when they found this IP address. They'll call up Comcast. Well, they won't call up Comcast. They'll subpoena Comcast. They'll go into court and say, listen, Comcast, this is a vital piece to our litigation. We need to know who was using the computer with this IP address at the time that we were looking at their computer. And Comcast will then turn over that file if they have it. They'll figure out who had that IP address and then file papers against that person. Phew.
that was a mouthful right there. So we have MAC addresses and IP addresses, and I think probably a good analogy to use is those are sort of like postal addresses that people use for their residences. It's sort of a way that you can locate somebody and send things to them through the postal service. You're sending post, of course, but over the internet you are sending data in a sense, and the ISPs, at least for residential connections, are usually the entity that is issuing these IP addresses. And so it's a method of sort of determining who is connected, or at least at what point they are connecting to the internet. Is there any way that those can be incorrect?
Yes, there are several ways that those can be incorrect. So, I mean, one of the main issues in these is, while it may properly identify the computer, it may not properly identify who's using the computer at the time. The second and, I think, bigger issue is that there's really no check or balance on, first, whether or not the timestamps that the Media Century people are using are correct. You know, it's possible that their, you know, computer clock is off by multiple hours. It's possible that somebody screwed up when, you know, figuring out Eastern time zone versus Central time zone, wherever Media Century is. There are a lot of little tiny things that could add up. Another thing that apparently Media Century doesn't do is once they make these log files, they'll send them off to a server, but they will not do anything to make sure that the file isn't modified once it gets on the server. You know, they say that it's read-only, but there are other ways that you can do that are a lot more secure. Doing something called the checksum is a great way to make sure that the file that you get later is the same file that you put there before. There are all sorts of little security measures that, you know, taken alone, yeah, the information is probably accurate, but when you add them all up, you really have to wonder how accurate this information really is.
So I get this question a lot. Usually from friends and family and stuff, and they always pose it to me as some sort of hypothetical. And so the hypothetical goes, they have a wireless router that's set up that is either has some type of encryption on it or maybe no encryption at all, and they're concerned about third parties, other people coming onto their router, their wireless router, and downloading stuff from their access point, which would in this case be their IP address. So now the infringing activity is potentially linked to a single IP address, and what happens in these cases is that when the ISPs get subpoenaed, they indicate that the IP address at issue is owned by this person, and so therefore the RIAA will go after the person who is registered to use that particular IP address. But there are ways that those things can be spoofed and stuff. Can MAC addresses be spoofed too?
You can definitely spoof a MAC address. And with regard to right now I'm running a small wireless network in my room, in my apartment, and I have a laptop hooked up to the wireless network and I have a desktop, and both appear to have the same IP address. So if this wireless network was unsecure, if someone could connect to it, I could not know that they were connected and they would appear to have the same IP address that I do. And MAC addresses generally aren't available, to clients that connect to them except for through certain connections. Like, if you just go to a website, the website can't tell you your MAC address. using certain client software. I'm not sure about BearShare or LimeWire, but those might in some ways be able to tell your MAC address. Certainly the ISP might be able to know the MAC address of machines that connect to it. But in short, basically, yes, it's spoofable. IP addresses, when you have a router, you can't really tell how many machines are necessarily behind that at a general first pass. So
what this comes down to, and I'll let you chime in a sec, Ben, is that we or people are starting to, and have always possibly, question the evidence that MediaCentury is gathering. How do you know, in the end of the day, that the evidence that they've gathered about a potential infringer is in fact correct? And you brought up the issue of timestamps, and timestamps are very important in terms of the reliability of certain types of evidence, because a timestamp indicates that a potential infringer downloaded a particular song file at a very particular time, and it's relevant to the case, and it needs to be reliable evidence, because you sort of need to prove that the machine in question, by the owner or registered user of the IP address, was in fact, you know, it was in fact online at that point, and that the file that was indicated to be downloaded was in fact downloaded. And if the timestamps don't match up, then the evidence clearly isn't all that reliable, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. There is a big problem with this, is that in that MediaCentury, you know, the RIAA will call their MediaCentury expert up, and they'll go through this step by step and explain, you know, why they think that it's this person. And it's kind of hard to walk that back as a defense attorney, to say, you know, well, this thing was wrong, and this thing was wrong, and this little thing was wrong, and this little thing was wrong. While that tends to work more in criminal trials, where the plaintiff has a higher, the state usually has a higher burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In civil trials, it's a lot harder to walk an expert back like that and say, well, this little thing was off and this little thing was off. And when you take all of that, you still haven't reached your burden of a preponderance of the evidence. It's the technique is less effective, and it's very difficult to contest this kind of evidence that way. Did I answer your question in the least?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know that there was necessarily a question there, but certainly some general comments were appreciated. This sort of like underscores, I think, some of the problems that we've seen with the RIAA suing people that don't have computers, or in some cases are actually deceased people that were not alive at any time during the period in which infringing activity was alleged. And there's a lot of question to the techniques that are actually used by MediaCentury. Not a lot is known about it, because in almost all instances, as far as I know, what has happened is defendants in a case like this have sort of said, we want to know the exact methods that MediaCentury used to determine that I was a potential infringer. And in almost all of those cases, MediaCentury has tried to claim some sort of privilege or confidentiality between MediaCentury and the RIAA. And I don't think that they have ever really been compelled to describe their exact methods. And all we really have is sort of a lot of speculation about it. You guys have any more thoughts on this?
Oh, I was just going to say that routers and ISPs can definitely tell what your MAC address is. For a while, I had my wireless router set up to only allow computers with certain MAC addresses on the network. And as far as I know, that's pretty much the most secure way you could set up a network, because unless somebody has physical access to your network, there's pretty much no way of getting into it. And I would highly recommend that if people dig around into their routers, setting up their networks like that. It's a bit of a pain to add new computers to it, but it's, like I said, it's the most secure way that I can think of to ensure that no one else is going to get on your network and, you know, use your network to share files and possibly open you up to RIAA litigation.
At the same time, and I guess this is sort of a caveat, that you might not want to secure your network that much, because if you do get into that situation, it can help to say that, well, my network was unsecure, so anyone could have been using it at the time.
At the same time, I would not recommend that as a legal strategy. You got to wonder
right. How
likely a... I mean, because among other things, they're going to have access to your hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So how likely is a jury to buy, well, anyone could have been using my network? I'm not convinced a jury will buy that as an appropriate defense to copyright infringement.
I wasn't implying it should be used as a defense to copyright infringement, but I guess there's the school of thought that wireless access points should people try to share them and just sort of because it's nice sometimes if you're in a strange neighborhood and you can find a wireless access point. So instead of just meeting locked networks everywhere, I guess. So
that's fair.
The wrinkle in this case was sort of the fact that she had this mostly inoperable computer, and you know, prior to the time that the lawsuit was filed, she gave the computer off to a relative to fix it, and he swapped out the hard drive in the end of the day after sanitizing the machine and recycled it, whatever that means, but that's what the news posts were reporting. So the RIAA didn't have access then to the actual hard drive, so it was almost through circumstantial evidence, which means that you don't have direct evidence of an actual infringement occurring, since you don't have the hard drive there, so you can't prove that the files in question were in fact downloaded onto it, because now the machine has a new hard drive. The question then sort of turns on circumstantial evidence or indirect evidence of infringement, and what they are relying on in this case is the media century reports that, you know, that at these particular times, files were downloaded, and you sort of have to rely on the evidence that Media Century is providing that there were, in fact, downloads.
Right. Another interesting dichotomy between this case and the Jamie Thomas case is that in the Jamie Thomas case, there was a similar destruction of the hard drive, but in the Jamie Thomas case, it happened after Jamie Thomas knew or should have known that she should have kept the hard drive. And as a result,
the suit, I think, had been filed, and this is something we didn't discuss last week, and it was an interesting point, and I think we kind of left it out because it sort of happened more than a year ago, and it wasn't really relevant to the case anymore. But after the suit had been filed, and she'd been served papers and stuff, and you can speculate as far as you like as to the reason why the hard drive had been replaced after the suit was filed. I think it might make her look a little bit less innocent in the end of the day. Obviously, the distinction between the Thomas case and this case is that the hard drive had been replaced before any papers had been served.
Right. Anything else for this case?
No, I think we're good. Dominic, do you have anything else to add?
I think we're good.
So our final news story that we saw today was pretty interesting, I think, and it involves iTunes gift cards. And iTunes gift cards, I mean, I see them everywhere. I don't know about you guys. You see them in Best Buy. I've seen them in my local supermarket grocer. And basically, they have set dollar amounts set to them, and you can buy them. And I think what happens when you buy them, I've never actually used one myself, is that they get registered and activated, and then the purchaser can then go back and either, you know, give the card off to somebody else as a gift or use it for themselves to buy music on iTunes. Now, this couple in Illinois bought a bunch of these cards, and on the card themselves is a little quotation that basically says, you, by buying this card, you can download X amount of dollars worth of entertainment on the iTunes store. And sort of underneath that is this little caption that says, songs are 99 cents, and I think video works are $1.99. So since about April 2009, iTunes has actually changed their pricing scheme, and they've gone to a variable pricing scheme. What's going on there, Ben?
Yes. So when iTunes was released, one of their big selling points was that every song in the catalog was going to be 99 cents. And Apple apparently worked very hard to keep that the case. Eventually, some competition started coming out in the market, notably Amazon's MP3 store. And Amazon had the noted feature of it being DRM-free. And Apple needed to compete with, you know, these DRM-free stores. And the way they got their music to be DRM-free and higher bitrate, I'd like to add, is by making a concession to the recording industry that the recording industry would have some power to price these songs. So not all songs would be 99 cents. There'd be some songs that were $1.29, and there'd be some songs that were 69 cents. So what happened here is that the plaintiffs in this case bought some iTunes gift cards. I think it says two $25 gift cards in March of 2008 and a $15 gift card in May of 2009. And all three of those gift cards had that little note on the back that says all songs are 99 cents. When the pricing changed after April 7th, 2009, that wasn't the case. Some of the songs were $1.29. And the plaintiffs in this case, it's actually a class action on behalf of all people across the United States who are similarly bamboozled by the 99-cent disclaimer, 99-cent little thing on the back of the card that says, you know, all songs on iTunes are 99 cents.
Right, so they're basically alleging several claims, but you can sort of summarize them as a breach of contract claim. And I think what they're saying there is that this little disclaimer on the back of those iTunes cards constitutes some sort of binding legal contracts. And since they are representing that the songs are 99 cents, after the point at which the iTunes store switched over to this variable pricing scheme, that was no longer true. And some songs were 99 cents, some songs were $1.29, and therefore, it was a misrepresentation of fact on the card. And that sort of couples into the second claim, which is this case, by the way, was filed in Illinois, and the name of the case is Owens et al. v. Apple, and if anyone wants to follow it online. And the second claim was under an Illinois statute, which said, which prohibits fraud and deceptive business practices, basically. And what they're requesting is a 30-cent refund on songs based on this contract. Do you guys have any thoughts on this at all? Do you think this is a sort of like an odd lawsuit at all, or does it have any merit?
I'd like to point out that they're only seeking it. The remedies they're seeking are, it's very specific. They want a 30-cent refund for any songs that were purchased for $1.29 using an iTunes gift card that had the all songs are 99 cents on the back of it.
Right, right. Yeah. And have they certified the class yet, by the way?
You know? I'm almost certain they have not. This was filed very recently, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, it was filed this week, I think on actually the 24th, that would be last week. But, so what's involved in a class action suit? How do you get a class action suit?
The first thing that they're going to have to do is, well, Apple, they've alleged that they, in their complaint, that they want a class action suit. Among the things you need for a class action suit are, too many plaintiffs to reasonably have in one lawsuit, which is almost certainly the case here. I have no idea how many millions of people have bought iTunes gift cards, but there are a lot of people across the United States who have brought iTunes gift cards. You need a common question of law or fact between all of these claims. In this case, it would be whether or not this formed a binding contract, whether or not there were deceptive trade practices. The damages would be essentially the same in all of these cases. And another thing you need is that the balance of the equities goes in favor of, all in all, it's better to have a class action than to let these people pursue these cases individually. And these kinds of cases tend to be very good for class actions, where you've got a lot of very small damages and a lot of very uniform harm across a group of people.
So I've mentioned before that you can get these cards at a lot of different stores. In the case, I think some of the cards were bought at Sam's Club and Walmart, and the complaint also lets that they're available through Best Buy and Walgreens and I think some other stores too. Who's the culpable party here in the end of the day? I mean, is it really Apple? Do we know if Apple has even reprinted these cards at all with a different disclaimer on the back that doesn't have that 99 cents thing? Do the stores have any liability in the end of the day for not updating their inventory stock that's available on the floor?
If the stores do have any liability, they haven't been sued in this case. And I don't know if Apple's... Have either of you picked up an Apple gift card recently?
No.
I have not. Nope.
Yeah, I haven't either. My guess is if Apple hadn't changed the writing on the back of them before now, they will as of tomorrow. Or very, very shortly after this. Yeah.
So the stores aren't in the suit yet. Do you think they could be joined as parties to the suit? We don't know in the end of the day. I mean, we're totally speculating here, but do you think there's any legal liability there?
It's a tough one.
For the stores?
Yes, for the stores.
Yeah.
That would
so,
be
I mean, the theory
rather
would
unlikely.
Be.
I mean, they're just stocking something that they have shipped in, and I don't think they're going to be reading the tiny print disclaimers on the back of cards.
There are all
nor
sorts
should they
of
be
cases.
Expected to be.
There are all sorts of cases where stores are liable for things that they have on their shelves. If a store, if you know your local supermarket stocks chicken that has salmonella in it, and you know the chicken was shipped directly from the chicken factory, they're still liable for any damages that you have. That's a strict products liability thing. And let me emphasize, it is a strict products liability thing. It has to do with, you know, personal injury that happened as a result of a product that they stocked. Which is very different, mind you, from contract suits or fraudulent claims, but false ads in this case. I don't think it's an open and shut case that the stores have no liability here.
Yeah, I think in part, or at least my reading, is that if there was some sort of communication between Apple and the stores which were stocking these cards, that they were changing their pricing schemes and coming out with new cards, or you know that they would be releasing new cards to reflect the change in pricing on the back of the cards or something like that. Those are certainly facts that would give rise to a legal liability.
I
don't know that there are too many other circumstances, none that I can think of right now.
I'm set with that.
So you had, and Ben, by the way, Ben had emailed me this story earlier this week, and he thought it was sort of a funny case, but I gave it a second look, and you know, I think it is pretty interesting because it just kind of goes to show that the types of things that you are selling in stores always have to have non-fraudulent representations in the cards, especially where they might give rise to some sort of contract liability. Another interesting question in this case is whether or not this language could even constitute some sort of contract. What does it take to have a contract or something like that?
Dominic, you wanna tackle that one?
What does it take to have a contract for?
What does it take to have a contract for anything? I mean, what are the basic parts of contract law?
An offer, an acceptance, consideration.
Right. So, can we say that this little quotation is an offer to any extent?
Yeah, I think
you can argue that.
Yeah, this is certainly an offer for sale. Apple is offering to sell a $15 gift certificate solely for the use of iTunes, and they're making a representation that all songs on iTunes are 99 cents.
And what's consideration? Just so our listeners know.
A peppercorn. that's a law school joke. Basically, consideration is some sort of trade or some sort of, I mean, traditionally it's some sort of value exchanged. In this case, it'd be the money that they paid for the gift card.
Right. That's essentially what it is. Consideration is both parties have to be giving up something in order for this to be an actual agreement. Otherwise, otherwise, it's a unilateral contract, or it's not a contract at all. It's just two people who, you know, were talking about something and agreed to do it. But it doesn't have any type of legally binding effect unless you have all of these elements, offer, acceptance, and consideration, and promises on both sides of an agreement.
Can either of you distinguish, and I always have trouble articulating this, a mere advertisement from an offer?
No.
It's tough. Some court cases have said, and there are tons of things out there like this, that if you walk into a department store or something like that, and you have a sign up that says shirts, you know, and you have a table of shirts, $12.99. Is that enough to constitute an offer?
And usually it isn't. In order to constitute an offer, it would have to have some sort of limited quantity. Like the first 10 people who come to the store this morning will get fur coats for $1 each. That's generally considered an offer to engage in what's called a unilateral contract. A unilateral contract is, it's a promise for performance of something. The store is promising to sell you this for $1 if you come in and buy it. You can't then call up the store and say, I promise I'll buy that. That's not the type of contract that they were offering. The only way to fulfill the contract that the store is offering with their offer for a sale of a limited number of items at a special price is to actually come down and do it. In this case, it's not really a unilateral contract. At least I don't think it's a unilateral contract that they're alleging. It would be a bilateral contract that, you know, they are purchasing this gift card, and Apple is, maybe it is a unilateral contract.
It's an interesting question.
Yeah. Because you can look at it either way. You can look at it, they're promising to spend that money at the iTunes store because they've already purchased the gift, because they're about to purchase the gift card. And Apple, in exchange, is promising to sell songs for 99 cents and videos for $1.99 and up. Or you can look at it as Apple is promising to sell songs for 99 cents or $1.99 and videos for $1.99 and up. And in exchange for that, and the only way to fulfill that promise is to actually purchase the gift card, which is kind of the dichotomy between a promise for performance and a promise for a promise.
So do you think in the end of the day, do you think that there are some good legal arguments here that this is potentially a contract then, and it might be a breach of contract, meaning that one of the parties, in this case Apple, has not fulfilled its legal obligations under the offer that they gave by indicating that songs were 99 cents rather than some other variable pricing scheme like the one that has existed since April of this year?
I think the consumer protection claim is the better claim than the contracts claim, but it seems like there are legitimate arguments on both sides. Do you have a feeling on this either way, Dominic?
I agree there's probably legitimate arguments. My gut feeling is probably Apple will... it depends on whether it was... whether it was just oversight that this just kept going, or they'll argue that, well, the gift card gives you just funding on iTunes and the terms of the iTunes store itself supersede. There might be something like that on the card. I don't have a gift card. I can't take a look at what says on the back. And I'm sure they'll try to argue that they didn't intend to bind themselves into a 99-cent situation, let alone bind themselves into misleading consumers.
Yeah, one more thing that I'd like to point out before we move on is that there are two breach of contract claims. There's one breach of contract claim that says people who bought these cards before the price change and held on to the cards after the price change, that their contract was breached because Apple changed the terms, changed the terms of the iTunes Music Store afterward. The other one is that the other breach of contract claim is for people who bought the iTunes Music Store cards after the price changed, but before the copy on the back of the cards was updated. I haven't gotten a chance to go through that in detail and see if there's, a legitimate difference or important difference between the two. But there certainly is. They raised both of those as independent claims.
And finally, I guess an important thing to note is the cards actually only state a dollar amount. They don't actually say a number of songs. The plaintiffs are deriving the number of songs based on the assumption that the songs are for 99 cents, which it may say on the gift card that they are on 99 cents, but I'm pretty sure that there's going to be some sort of text on the card that says the store controls and terms may change at any time. I'd be very surprised if that didn't exist.
Well, I unfortunately do not have one of these cards in front of me, and at this point all we have is the complaint filing, and as often happens when we're discussing these complaints as they get filed within the last week, we have insufficient information. And we don't really know. I mean, we just know at this point that there are these two separate statements, one of which says that you can download X dollar amount worth of entertainment from the iTunes store by using this card, and the other that states that songs are 99 cents and $1.99. And I guess the distinction there would be that perhaps one is more of a binding contractual statement, and Apple would obviously want to argue that the card only allows you to download a certain dollar amount worth of entertainment. And the second would be that the songs are 99 cents or $1.99 either constitute some conditions on the contract or some other limitation on the type of goods that you can actually purchase.
Mm-hmm. I did some searching and I actually found an image of the card. Basically what it says is download your favorite songs, TV shows, and music videos, buy songs for 99 cents. And it doesn't say all songs. It doesn't say just songs are only available for 99 cents. So I'm going to predict that Apple will prove victorious here.
Yeah, was it also a breach of contract if anybody went and bought a album that had 10 songs on it and only paid $7.99 for the album? Because, you know, Apple made some money off of that deal.
Right, the other way.
Yeah, can
well, that's a great distinction too, actually, because if you buy songs in an entire album versus buying them individually, the pricing scheme again shifts, and that's something that they've always had on iTunes, as far as I know, is that you know you could buy a song for 99 cents, but you could also buy 15 songs for $12.99 or something like that, right?
Right. I mean, it varies from album to album, and there are some albums that are just priced at the cost of all of the individual songs, and there are some that are priced less if they have more songs on them. There are even some albums that if tracks are long enough, I think the cutoff at least used to be 8 minutes or longer, you could only buy it if it was part of the entire album, if you bought the entire album. So, you know, that may be another grounds for breach of contract on Apple's part, that there are some songs that you cannot purchase for, that you cannot now and never could purchase for 99 cents. You could only purchase them as part of an album.
Mm-hmm. Certainly for the breach of contract claims, I mean, interesting arguments here, and it's way too early to try to figure out which way this is going to go. What was reported in the news stories was that the couple in question had actually attempted to contact Apple and, you know, try to get some sort of non-legal recourse first before actually filing the suit. And as far as I can tell, it looks like Apple either didn't respond or refused to provide any type of reimbursement based on the couple's reliance on what was stated on the back of the card. So, any concluding thoughts as we sort of kick this one to the curb?
No, not really. I'm all set with this story. Dominic?
I'm going to predict Apple's victorious, so.
Oh, I was going to predict that Apple settled. If we were making predictions, man, I would have.
Okay.
Well, predictions are included. I'm sorry.
Settled is incorporated, perhaps, in victorious. I don't know, depending on the value of the settlement.
Yeah.
I guess we'll see where this one goes, and we'll just have to keep our eyes out, and we'll be sure to update everybody when we do have some new news on it. So before we kind of conclude today, there were two other interesting stories which popped up this week. Actually, there are even more than two, but if we tried to cover everything, we would have like a four-hour podcast, and no one would want to listen to it. But first off, there was some news on the Pirate Bay trial abroad.
Right. So their appellate system is incredibly fast, and after the guilty verdicts had come down, the defendants in the Pirate Bay case challenged the judge on the grounds that he was biased in the case, and they appealed that very shortly after they were convicted, and the court already ruled that the judge either was not biased or whatever bias he had no effect on the trial. So the guilty verdicts will stand in those cases.
Do you guys remember what the bias claim was? I will confess that I didn't actually go back and look at it. That was kind of silly of me. But there was a bias claim. I think that the judge was involved in some sort of groups that were related to copyright holders.
The bias, I think, was stemming from the fact that he was a member of the Swedish Copyright Association, which that association has some lawyers that represent copyright holders. And he also sits on the board for the Swedish Association for the Protection of Industrial Property, which is an advocacy group that wants more rigorous copyright laws.
So the claim was that there was some sort of conflict of interest because the judge had some sort of personal
Not so much conflict of interest, just that he, by virtue of his associations, elicited a sense of bias because he was favoring one side because that's what he seemed to publicly agree with based on the groups that he was a member of.
Yeah, in America, we would consider this it's not, it may be a partial risk of bias, but it's also a risk of the feeling that he had prejudged the case, that the defendants here would not be getting a fair trial because of the judge's views on copyright infringement and copyrights in general.
My knowledge of Swedish law is very poor, but does this pretty much conclude the case? Do you guys know if there's any additional grounds for appeal after this?
I have no idea.
It's a complicated legal system, and if you go to like the websites trying to figure stuff out, a lot of it is in Swedish to begin with, so it's tough to understand for us. But at least
from what I can understand, they can still appeal the results of the first trial, but they're not going to get a new trial. So it would be an appeal of the trial, which means the trial would stand.
Okay, so this was mostly about trying to retry the case itself. All right, well, that was some interesting news. And on another story that we have covered in previous weeks, the SciStar case. And if you recall, SciStar is the tiny little Florida corporation which about a year ago announced that they were going to start selling Mac clones. But the clones in question were basically PC devices, meaning non-Apple manufactured hardware, and they were running OS X. And just about a year ago now, it would be a year in July, Apple filed suit against them, stating that SciStar was in effect violating the end user license agreement, or the EULA, which strictly prohibits installing or enabling others to install OS X on non-Apple labeled hardware. And a few weeks ago, we reported that SciStar had actually gone bankrupt, and or at least they had filed for bankruptcy in a Florida court. And based on that bankruptcy filing, the effect was, or maybe one of the filings are, and we will all confess, I think the three of us do not have a great understanding of bankruptcy law, but one of the side effects was that it put a stay on the Apple litigation that was going on. And this week it was announced that the stay has been lifted, and the bankruptcy judge, because it's a Florida corporation, so the bankruptcy proceeding, as far as I know, is being conducted down in Florida, and the litigation between Apple and SciStar is actually occurring in California. And the bankruptcy judge basically allowed for the stay to be lifted on the litigation, and that was provided that Apple agreed not to pursue monetary damages in the case against SciStar. And we had talked a little bit about some of the issues in the SciStar case, and there are tons too, and it would be impossible to try to summarize them right now. There's been a lot of question over the years about the ultimate effectiveness of EULAs, but at this point in time, they are still ultimately binding legal devices to the extent that they comply with general contract law. And it's still sort of unclear about whether or not a company such as Apple, in this case, might be misusing their copyright that they have on the underlying software in OS X and essentially binding or bundling or tying the software into some sort of illegal by way of antitrust law and imposing additional restrictions to the end user. Unfortunately, now the stay has been lifted and the suit looks like it's going to continue forward. So we'll have an ultimate ruling on this case probably sometime in the next 12 months or so, depending on how things go. But this was certainly a big blow for SciStar, considering they probably don't have very much money anymore to pay their legal fees. And I don't understand what the effect of filing a bankruptcy claim has on pending litigation issues and payment to attorneys, but certainly there has to be some sort of effect. Do you guys have any other thoughts on this before we close this one out?
If there's one thing that I think we should take away from this, it's that Apple picked this case and is actively pursuing it. Apple is looking to get a ruling one way or the other as to whether or not its end-user license agreement is effective at preventing people from making Hackintoshes or from having other people enable people to install Apple software, specifically OS X, on non-Apple branded computers. Apple could have walked away from this once SciStar filed for bankruptcy, and I think a lot of companies would, fearing that the litigation would come out against them. It seems like Apple is very committed, though, to seeing this one through to the end.
Dominic?
Sounds like a great summary.
Well, we'll have to see where this thing goes, and who knows, there might be some merit still to some of SciStar's claims. I think that some areas of the law, particularly concerning the misuse of copyright claims, have not been decided in any major jurisdiction, and so we'll just have to see where it goes. There could still be very well still be some merit to the claims, and I guess we'll see what happens. But thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I was your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me is...
Dominic Rabier.
And Ben Snitkoff.
Please be sure to check out our website at www.technicallylegal.org, and we'll see you next week.